Get road trip ready with a service checkup at your local Chevy dealer. They can save you time and money and get the job done right the first time, worry-free. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for current service specials or to schedule a test drive.
Hey. All right. Let's do some podcasting. What do you say, Reg? How you doing, my friend? Thumbs up. Very good. Now transfer to that trigger finger, that index finger, and get ready to hit the button. Okay? All right. Put it in the books. Episode 450. What are we at? Three? Yeah. 453. Wow. Getting up there. Star, smile, strong. Let's hit this thing. Three, two, one. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget, it's always fun to listen. But you can really get a sense of accomplishment if you get out there and put in a little extra effort. So tell your friends, tell your family, tell anybody who listens to a podcast that you know that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and you should tell them, my gosh, why aren't you listening? Send them a link. Give them a free sample. They're all free. And let them know what you've been enjoying so much that they can too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. And of course, to you loyal listeners out there, if you want to keep up to date on what we've been talking about recently or what we've been talking about for months or even years, going back 2 or 3 years, it's all there at WGNRadio.com. Go to the podcast section, hit the prompt for this podcast, and there they are. Podcast after podcast after podcast. Scroll down, load more. Get ready. Here's episode 453. So, here we are, venturing into, can you believe it, the last week of January? Doesn't it seem like we just talked about Christmas? Doesn't it seem like we just talked about New Year's? And pretty soon we'll be talking about what happened in January. Woo! As I said, heck of a month, no doubt. And a lot of news happening in the month of January. One of the things that I wanted to make sure did not get lost in the shuffle, because we had so many huge and important news stories, as I said in last week's podcast, that happened right out of the box here at the beginning of 2025, that there were some other issues and news events that occurred during that time, but many times they were overshadowed because of the enormity of the things that had been going on in January. The New Orleans attack, terrorist attack, as well as the explosion in Las Vegas on January 1st, and then the L.A. fires, which are still burning, and the area is now being expanded as though Santa Ana winds just will not stop. And then, of course, the long overdue ceasefire, at least temporarily, and the release of beginning of the release of some hostages from the Israeli Hamas conflict that's been going on since October 7th of 2023. And then, of course, we had the inauguration of Donald Trump as our 47th president, which was historic in that he's only the second president to become a non-consecutive president, meaning that he did not have two terms in a row, but two terms, but non-consecutively. So a lot of things that changed this country in many ways, our landscape, our perspective, and who knows what. So January 2025 is going to certainly go down as a memorable month of the year. And now the rest of them, the rest of those months, hey, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, and December, you got your work cut out for you. January is representing. January's like, hey, you're going to remember me in a year's time. And hopefully it'll be about more happy news than negative news. We can only hope that our remaining world conflict out there, major world conflict in Ukraine, hopefully after more than 3 years, comes to an end as well as other things around the world. But so strap in. If January is any indication, 2025, I'm not sure if it's going to be a good year or a bad year, but it's going to be a memorable one. That's for sure. It already is. But like I said, one of the things that did occur amidst all these other major big events was something that sent a little bit of sadness through me, as if we didn't have enough in January. But it was one that I wanted to make sure that I was able to recognize and to talk about to some extent, because it really did hit me right in the gut. And that was the death a couple of weeks ago of the Oscar-winning filmmaker David Lynch. Now, some of you may have never seen a David Lynch film. Some of you may have only seen one or two pieces of his work. And some of you may be like me, who are just David Lynch fanatics. He is was and will always be, as his work and his art and his memory will live on long past his time here. But he was and is one of the most enigmatic and interesting and bizarre and strange and thoroughly creative and artistic beings that I think that some of us have ever have ever seen in our lifetimes. And it was really a sad loss to see David Lynch pass away. Even though he was 78 years old, which is certainly a long life, sadly he was diagnosed last year with emphysema. And if anybody has ever seen anything with David Lynch, you wouldn't be surprised. I didn't know he had emphysema, but I wasn't surprised that he passed away at 78. I assumed maybe he had some kind of cancer. Apparently, they made this announcement about his emphysema last year, but I didn't see that in the news. But I wouldn't, as I said, it's no surprise, because David Lynch was rarely seen, at least on film or in interviews or anywhere, without a cigarette. The man just smoked, and he was a chain smoker in every sense of the word. And it added to his mystique. He struck quite a visual image. A tall, kind of lanky guy with a long face and an incredible, incredible head of hair. Even at age 78, that hair was the envy of anyone who ever saw it. It went from brown to gray, but it stood tall and high and wildly styled. And wow, David Lynch's hair was an entity, was a creative entity unto itself, that only helped to create and maintain his mystique. But part of his mystique, as I said, he struck quite a unique and imposing and interesting visual image, and it was defined by this his wild crop of hair and a cigarette. And of course, a damn good cup of coffee. In fact, he frequently talked about living the art life. And I have to say, if there's anyone who lived the life of an artist in almost every sense of the word, it was David Lynch. He completely succumbed and completely paid homage to creativity. And he completely dedicated himself to art and creativity and opened himself up to ideas and imagination and really created a body of work on film as well as a painter. He started as a painter that there's not many filmmakers who have been able to define their own genre of filmmaking. You hear of Hitchcockian, named after Alfred Hitchcock. So if there's a film that is interesting, is a mystery that takes twists and turns and takes you down different roads that you don't expect to, and then you wind up coming back and it's circular and it's a great surprise at the end, or it's a great fear or a shock, that's the style of Alfred Hitchcock in almost every film he made. And those elements came to define an Alfred Hitchcock film that he made. And when you saw others make similar films who were obviously influenced by Alfred Hitchcock films and used parts of his filmmaking toolbox, you would describe a film in that genre as Hitchcockian. There are not many filmmakers who had such a distinct filmmaking presentation that when a film just starts, you know who it was made by. And if you see passages of similar images or similar filmmaking techniques in other films, you know that they were influenced by that person. David Lynch was one of those. His films and those that were influenced by him could be called Lynchian. And as I said, that's no small compliment. But he really did define a specific kind of avant-garde, abstract filmmaking that was at times strange and abrasive and confusing and mysterious and sexy and convoluted and confused and nonlinear and dark and macabre and loud. And yet, through all those seemingly negative things, there was always a sense of optimism and wonder and peace amidst all that chaos and confusion when we think about a David Lynch film and a story and the images. They really were like dreams brought to life. And as I said, he wasn't a filmmaker for the masses. And yet, that's the great thing about him. He never looked for mainstream success. And as odd and strange as his films were, they still found a mainstream success. He still found a mainstream success. He certainly was living in a spot of as I said before, avant-garde and cult status, no question. David Lynch wasn't for everyone. But what was exciting about David Lynch, in the same way that you can look at a Picasso painting, Picasso came to prominence with his cubist movement when he dissected the image that people were used to. And so it became kind of a joke in the 50s and 60s to make fun of Picasso. Oh, it's got four noses and three eyes. And but what Picasso was doing through cubism was deconstructing what we were so used to seeing. But if you go back and you look at pop, and people said, well, anybody could do that. What the heck is this guy? What kind of artist or painter is this? Now, these are the people that looked at art more like a very traditional way of art being almost like a photograph, a very literal interpretation of reality. A tree was a tree. A person had two eyes and a nose and a face, and it was the way they appeared. And Picasso, with his cubism and his other his styles later in life, basically took all the elements and said, no, we could start to look at things in a different way and still feel the humanity, still feel an emotion, but look at things in a different way. And that was probably part out of his own restlessness. Because if you look at Pablo Picasso's early work before cubism, before his more abstract periods, he was a great painter. And he painted in the, at that time, accepted and recognized styles. And there are years of Picasso painting in a style that the average person could look at and say, oh, okay, that's a nice painting. They weren't challenged by it in terms of its construction. It was a portrait of a person. It was a portrait of a scene, of a landscape. And it was representative of that. But Pablo Picasso was such a great artist and so restless that he had conquered that kind of painting early in his life. And so he needed to break the mold and do something different. That was nothing. He could do that in his sleep. And that's where cubism began, where he started to challenge not only himself and his art, but the audience itself. And that's what David Lynch did through his films. Very similar. David Lynch could make a very compelling, straight kind of film. He did. And they were very successful, and they were very popular. And they still had echoes of the absurdist David Lynch. But he could do that. But to him, that was easy stuff. He was always challenging himself and challenging the audience. I first became a David Lynch fan, and I didn't even know it. In 1980, as a young kid, as a teenager, I first saw The Elephant Man. And I didn't know. I was a teenager. I didn't even pay attention to really who was directing films. But I remember seeing The Elephant Man. And even at a young age, black and white film, a very, you know, difficult, dark film of the story of John Merrick, who in Victorian England, born with this horrible birth defects, that he was nicknamed the Elephant Man, and he was just vilified and used as a carnival freak, and in a time when people had no regard for people's feelings, and he faced horrible hatred and prejudice. And yet, thankfully, there's a few people around him that gave him compassion for his reality and saw past his physical and found that there was a very intelligent and feeling and worthy person behind all the physical deformities. It's a great film. It's a compelling story. It's so well made. It's so well acted. Anthony Hopkins, Anne Bancroft, and John Hurt as John Merrick, who was nominated for an Academy Award, and directed by David Lynch. As I said, I had no idea that David Lynch directed this film, but I knew that it touched me. I know that today it is one of my favorite films. As difficult as it is, it just tugs at your heartstrings. There are scenes in there that are difficult to watch. There are scenes that are Lynchian, as I said before. But it's basically a mainstream film. It was nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, and including Best Director for David Lynch. And I believe he was only, 30 years old at the time. So I was attracted to his filmmaking from a young age and never knew it was him. And then later, when I started to discover more of his work, when I read about him and saw that he directed The Elephant Man, I was like, wow, well, I could see why I like Blue Velvet, or I could see why I like Twin Peaks, or I could see why I like Mulholland Drive, or I could see why I like Wild at Heart, because many years ago, even without knowing it, I was a fan of David Lynch's. And not only did he, as I said, he made, you know, very, very traditional films. Elephant Man certainly has its, as I said, its moments of the macabre. Its main character is not something easy to understand, and is strange and at times grotesque, which is part of the Lynchian tools, as I said before, in filmmaking. But if you've never seen, if you want to start to get into David Lynch, if you're afraid of, well, I've heard these movies are kind of weird, and don't get me wrong, David Lynch films are not easy. They're not linear. I don't understand everything that's going on. Anybody who tells you they understand everything about a David Lynch movie is lying to you. I don't even know sometimes if David Lynch knew what his movies or certain scenes were really about. I've read so much about him. I know that the actors that were in the films were constantly asking him, "What? Where are we? What is this? Why is this?" And his answer was, we'll see where the story takes us, even though he had written it in most cases. But if you want a starter kit for David Lynch, because I'm sure that if you've been online or anywhere else, you've seen a lot of stories about David Lynch's passing, and you've seen many people just pay huge, huge compliments to him. And he may be completely off your radar screen. If you're familiar with David Lynch films, then I'm preaching to the choir. But I have a feeling that most people have not been exposed to too many David Lynch films. And it's to you I'm speaking to, really. Because I'd love for you to experience these films and have an open mind and go into them realizing, just like as I said before with Picasso, that what you're going to see may not be completely within your understanding. We are used to linear stories that have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and they're all connected. That is not a David Lynch film. You say, well, Jim, then I'm not interested in that. Well, then I think you're missing out on something. because his visual images are so unique, so creative, that you just want, it's sometimes, it just baffles you. You're trying to figure out what is he showing me, and then why is he showing me? It's not easy. I'm not going to lie to you. And as I said, I'm not going to pretend like I understand every bit of imagery or metaphor that David Lynch is putting forth. But I know that as I'm watching the film, and as it ends, when it ends, I say to myself, wow, I just saw something. I don't really know what it was, and it makes me want to watch it again and again. And I keep finding new things. I may not really get all the answers to every question I had, but I certainly was affected and moved. And it made me think, and it made me get involved. You can't just watch a David Lynch film. There's a difference between watching a film and looking at a film. Most people just watch a film. But David Lynch, he forces you to look at a film. Look into it. Look at it. Figure it out. Look for the details. Delve into it. Every scene is unique. And every scene may not necessarily have anything to do with the one that preceded it, and may not even have anything to do with anything that comes after it. You say, Jim, what the heck are you talking about? As I said, it's almost like an abstract painting come to life. Now, I understand some people are not into abstract painting or abstract art. I get it. But I really think that you're missing something, because throughout all the images that David Lynch films present us, difficult at times to watch, scary, horrific, confusing, mysterious, there is a sense of optimism there too at the end of the day in these stories. And one reason why, whatever the images were in his films, they were always presented, I feel, with a sense of authenticity and honesty and truth to what was being told, or to those characters. But if you want a introduction class to David Lynch, I would suggest that you see The Elephant Man, because it really is a self-contained story and will give you a little beginnings hints of the way that David Lynch tells a story, and some of the images and some of the filmmaking styles that he puts into his storytelling. It will give you a little precursor. And then there's another one that, ironically, completely describes what kind of film it is. It's called The Straight Story. It is the most unconventional David Lynch film in his entire canon of films. And yet, it's probably the most mainstream accessible film about an old man who's got a dying wish and goes across the country on a lawnmower, on a riding lawnmower. It is pure David Lynch. And yet, it doesn't have all the wacky, crazy, strange, macabre, aggressive, dark, horrific. It's a very straight story. It's aptly titled. So I'd have you look that one up too. And if you like what you see in those two films, then I would hope that you'd start to get then a little more adventurous and really get into what we would call the classic David Lynch kinds of films. You know, like I said, he had quite a life and a career. He wasn't a prodigy. He wasn't all that interested in school. It wasn't like he was some straight A kid. But he was clearly a true creative. a true artist. As I said before, he lived the art life. In fact, as another precursor to David Lynch, once again, to those who might not be that familiar with him or with his work, and as I said before, it's not easy. His movies aren't easy to understand and sometimes to even stay with, because they're so convoluted at times. But one way to understand him better, there's a documentary that was made a few years ago called David Lynch, The Art Life. I believe it's on Netflix. It's on some streaming service. And it gives a nice insight to him as a person and as an artist and into his artistic vision of how he sees things and how he goes about his work. And it might help you better understand him, and then understand, if you start to see some of his other more classic Lynchian films, what goes behind it. So if you're new to David Lynch, I would suggest you first start by seeing this documentary called David Lynch, The Art Life. Then I would see The Elephant Man, and then I would see A Straight Story. And then I would start to say, okay, now it's time to get into a little David Lynch. But as he started, he moved around the country. He was born in Montana. His father worked for the Agricultural Department of the United States, so his family moved around. He moved and lived in many different parts of the country, which also infuses into his films. He lived in the Pacific Northwest, which obviously later influenced one of my all-time favorite TV shows, Twin Peaks, which took place in the Pacific Northwest. But he was also in the Midwest. He was also on the East Coast, in Boston, in Virginia, and Pennsylvania. And so he certainly saw and was influenced by different people and different parts of this country. At an early age, he showed a interest in and a talent for drawing. And by chance, as a teenager, he met a high school friend whose father was a painter. Not a house painter, but an artistic painter. And at a young age, he visited this artist's studio. And he said it was like a bomb went off. From that moment, he knew he wanted to be a painter. He didn't know up to that point that that was a way to make a living, that that was a profession. And he really was serious about it, and he dedicated himself to an artistic life at a very early age. He was somewhat of a loner, but at the same time he had a circle of friends, but he was definitely living the art life, which he a lot of times would describe as coffee, cigarettes, and discussions. The art life. And what do we talk about when we talk about the artistic renaissance or the artistic scene in Paris in the 20s? And 30s, when Picasso and others were just coming up, you hear about them sitting in Parisian cafes and sketching and eating and, you know, having coffee and smoking cigarettes. That's the art life. Well, David Lynch lived that. Sadly, the cigarette smoking of the art life probably helped cut his life short. 78 is certainly not a bad run, but in today's world, people are living into their 80s and 90s and even longer than that. So it's sad, because smoking is obviously a choice that we make, and it's a choice that we know it has detrimental results if you smoke for a long time, for most people. And at the same time, as I said before, though, that cup of coffee and especially that cigarette was so much a part of the David Lynch persona and image that I don't know if he ever regretted smoking or it was a necessary evil to live the art life. But he certainly had his share of luck that every successful person as well as artist needs, meeting the right people, having the right people identify his talent and help to push it out of no personal advantage of themselves, but just because they saw something very special in him and they wanted to help him move forward. That's a great, great generosity. And if you can find a mentor or mentors like that in your life, consider yourself very lucky. Doesn't come often, because it don't come around very often. But his artistic talent and his unique vision, while still very abstract and very on the fringes of mainstream art and mainstream thinking, was so unique and so creative at such a young age that even established artists were willing to go out on a limb for him. And he was able to get into prestigious art schools like the Boston Art School and the Pennsylvania Art School, and then the American Film Institute in Los Angeles, which is really what helped springboard him. And he was helped by older people who recognized something different about David Lynch. And to his credit, he fulfilled their expectations and their hopes. Most people will talk about a film when you read about David Lynch called Eraserhead. Now, I would say that while that's his first film, and he was in his early 20s when it was finished, that is not the one you want to see first. Please, I want you to be a David Lynch fan, and if you're not, as I said before, if you're not familiar with his work, I want you to first have some appetizers before you sink into the entree. Eraserhead is not one of the appetizers, because that one may scare you off of David Lynch forever. It is not an easy film to understand or to watch. It wasn't meant to be, which is part of the David Lynch charm and the David Lynch perspective. But you'll read about this film Eraserhead. You should see it if you start to get into David Lynch, because it is a very personal film. It was one that was somewhat autobiographical, and you say, really? If you ever see it, you'll say, how the heck is that autobiographical? I don't even know what's going on. It's kind of veiled metaphor for what he was going through in his life, of a young man whose young wife is suddenly pregnant and he fears fatherhood at a young age, whose child is born with a deformity, as his first child was, and as a fear for the world on the outside, as he was at the time when he grew up where he was living in a very rough part of Philadelphia, when he was going to the Pennsylvania art school. But at the same time, believe me, I've seen Eraserhead a couple of times, and it's pure David Lynch. But to his credit, as you say, well, this guy sounds a little too weird for me, Jim. I mean, you know, I appreciate you trying to sell me on David Lynch, but the way you're talking about him, it doesn't sound like this guy's my cup of tea. Well, you know whose cup of tea he was? Mel Brooks. Do you like Mel Brooks? Because Mel Brooks saw Eraserhead, and as crazy and as macabre and as confusing and as weird as it may be, Mel Brooks is the one who produced The Elephant Man. And it was Mel Brooks who hired David Lynch to make The Elephant Man on the strength of having seen Eraserhead. Yeah. You know who else was impressed with Eraserhead enough to offer David Lynch a plum job directing? If Mel Brooks doesn't impress you, then how about this name? How about George Lucas? Does that name sound familiar? He had that little thing called Star Wars. Yeah. Well, David Lynch and his Eraserhead film, as I said, not easy to watch, not easy to understand, but the images and the storytelling were so new, were so unique and so different and so creative that George Lucas offered David Lynch to direct the third film of the original Star Wars trilogy, Return of the Jedi. David Lynch could have, if he wanted to, directed a Star Wars film. You can't get any more mainstream than that. But to his credit, David Lynch turned the job down amazingly. The third original Star Wars film after Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back, every director in the world would have given their soul to direct the third and at that time supposedly final Star Wars film, Return of the Jedi. And yet David Lynch, who was approached by George Lucas, turned down the offer and actually urged George Lucas to direct it, which he did, because David Lynch said, this film is your vision. And I couldn't do service to your vision. I would have to put my vision in it, and it wouldn't be your vision. And this is your story, and you need to tell it. That's a heck of a integrity sandwich right there. But that's the way David Lynch felt about his own work. He had stories to tell. He had ideas to express. He had feelings to share. And they were his vision and his soul vision. And he felt as if he was the only one who could do it, who could bring those thoughts and ideas that he had percolating in his brain to life. So, yeah, David Lynch is not just some crazy guy who made some weird films. David Lynch was a very talented filmmaker who could make any kind of film. But he was so thoroughly a unique, visionary, and creative soul that he couldn't be encumbered by the usual boundaries and the usual expectations of what we would call a mainstream movie, of a movie and a story that had a logical beginning and a logical middle and a logical end. David Lynch's films started with one idea and they went off on seven different roads, and there was no guarantee that any of those roads that you were following during the film would ever have a definite conclusion or even a definite sense of why it was there or what it meant or what had happened and how it ended. But what was so great about a David Lynch film was, for all the confusion when it ended, for the most part, you couldn't wait to see it again. As I said, I after The Elephant Man in 1980, I didn't see another David Lynch film until 1986, Blue Velvet, which you may have heard of. A thoroughly entertaining, interesting, aggressive, odd, strange, mysterious, purely Lynchian film that not only boasted some great acting and some interesting imagery and storytelling, but also some great music that helped, ironically, resuscitate the career of Roy Orbison by using one of his songs that wasn't as well known as, say, Pretty Woman or Only the Lonely. Roy Orbison was a big hit in the 60s, but he really hadn't done anything in the 70s and certainly not in the 80s. But David Lynch used his song In Dreams in the most unusual way possible, thanks to Dean Stockwell's amazing performance of performing it, of lip-syncing it with a construction light as a microphone. Don't ask me to explain it. And of course, Dennis Hopper playing a psychotic killer who breathes oxygen. And it's you can't even explain Blue Velvet, except you can. It's a movie that parodies the great American, I wouldn't say dream, but the beautiful American landscape of the small town America with the picket fence and the lawn sprinklers and the nice little homes with porches. And what's so great about it, and that's the way the film actually opens, and you see this typically Americana setting. Kids riding bikes, manicured lawns, white picket fences, sprinklers on the lawn. And then the camera starts to zoom in to the grass. And it keeps zooming in until we see a cut-off ear being eaten by ants and maggots. And then the game is afoot. How did that ear get there? In this beautiful, bucolic, picturesque Americana city, there's clearly some dark danger. Ears just don't show up on lawns. Decapitate ears that are being eaten by maggots. And so it's kind of an odd mystery that gets into the dark underbelly of American society in ways that I can't even and don't even want to describe to you, because if you've never seen it, I don't want to ruin it for you. Once again, not an easy film to see sometimes, but I dare you to take your eyes off of it. Between the music and the imagery and the acting and some of the cinematography, it just grabs you and won't let you go. So when you're ready to start to really watch a David Lynch film after you've done your little precursor to David Lynch, like I told you, then I would definitely say you've got to see Blue Velvet to really understand now where the David Lynch vision is. And if you think that one is a little disjointed and a little weird, well, just wait until you start to see some more of them. But that one, at least, if you can grasp on to Blue Velvet and see and appreciate what he's trying to show and do in that film, And you, it will hopefully make you want to not only see Blue Velvet again, but then begin to discover some of his more films where he continues to push the envelope visually and push the envelope in terms of how to tell a story and how to make you feel. And that's what a David Lynch film does. And as much as I loved Blue Velvet and was completely enamored by it and just saw it, once the first time I saw it, I couldn't stop. I bought it on home video, and I just gobbled that film up, bought the soundtrack, just loved it. But really, when I became a David Lynch fan and aficionado forever, was when I watched the first episode of Twin Peaks. Never forget it, April 1999. I already now was aware of David Lynch and was a fan of David Lynch. And when I heard that David Lynch was going to present a TV show on network television, not on cable, not on HBO, not like, you know, today's world, all the cutting edge shows are all on streaming services or cable, right? Sopranos was on HBO. Breaking Bad was on cable. You know, you name it. Game of Thrones, all these different kind of groundbreaking shows. But back in 1986, the cable world was just beginning. Network television was still king, even though cable was certainly on the rise. I don't think there's any way in today's world that Twin Peaks ever gets on network television, because David Lynch wouldn't have brought it to network television. But at that time, that was the only place for it to be really seen and appreciated. But Twin Peaks changed television forever. And that is not an exaggeration. I don't know how old you are, but if you've come of age in the last 35 years, from after which Twin Peaks first debuted, then you have seen the result of mainstream entertainment, television and films, after Twin Peaks. You could say, well, what's so influential about Twin Peaks? Well, before that, without Twin Peaks, not only would a network, perhaps, whether it's a cable network or a television network, commercial network, be willing to do a show like The Sopranos, or like The X-Files, or like Breaking Bad, but the thought of them, the people that created them, probably wouldn't have even been inspired to create or write them without the creative inspiration of and storytelling that was put forth in Twin Peaks. It was that revolutionary. When I saw Twin Peaks in 1990, the first two-hour episode film about Laura Palmer, and once again, very similar in its initial storytelling, just like Blue Velvet of 3 or 4 years before, a lumber town in the Pacific Northwest, small town, bucolic town. And that's the way it starts, just the way Blue Velvet did. We see mountains and we see rivers and we see sawmills and we see homes and we see waterfalls and we just get this beautiful, tranquil feeling of this area in the Pacific Northwest called Twin Peaks. And then the first scene is a young, beautiful teenager whose dead body is found on the river's edge, wrapped in plastic. The homecoming queen is killed. And thus, who killed Laura Palmer became a catchphrase of 1990 and 1991. And it was similar in scope initially to Blue Velvet. But it took what Blue Velvet did and then just expanded on it in a cast of characters and twisted imagery and non-linear storytelling. And it captivated people. It became an immediate hit. It became an instant cult classic. People were, you know, it was so filled with idiosyncrasies, cherry pies and damn fine cups of coffee. Fans used to get together to watch Twin Peaks eating cherry pie and drinking coffee. It really was a phenomenon. But I remember watching it the first time, and thankfully I recorded it on my VHS in 1990. Thank God, because after I watched the two-hour premiere episode, I immediately rewound it and watched it again and rewound it and watched it again. It was the perfect melding of music and mood and imagery and scenery and storytelling and characters and all together. You didn't know at times what you were watching or where it was going, but you couldn't take your eyes off of it. And David Lynch wrote it and directed the first 7 episodes. And sadly, like everything on network television, it became such an instant hit that then the network started to interfere with David Lynch's vision. And they wanted it to become more of a traditional show. And that isn't David Lynch. And so sadly, he left the show, went on to make a new movie, and the show sort of became quirky for quirky's sake. And you started to see as the show went on and then was eventually canceled in 1991 after just 30 episodes, you could see what David Lynch kind of storytelling and movie making or TV movie making and writing is like when someone else tries to be David Lynch. It doesn't work. It doesn't feel real. It feels like a copy. And that's what sadly had happened. But David Lynch's initial vision, along with a TV writer and producer named Mark Frost, was unlike anything that ever happened on television. And as I said, even though it didn't last long itself and wasn't everybody's cup of tea, because it was very, you have to give David Lynch so much credit because he didn't compromise his vision for network television, which ultimately doomed the show. But more power to him that he stuck to his guns, because those first initial episodes of Twin Peaks for the first season and a half that he was involved were unlike anything you ever saw. And as I said, hugely influential in terms of the topics, in terms of how to tell a story, in terms of creating characters that people cared about. Interesting, quirky characters. As I said, you would not see a Breaking Bad without Twin Peaks. You would not see an X-Files without Twin Peaks. You would not see a Sopranos without Twin Peaks. You would not see a Dexter without Twin Peaks. You would not see a 6 Feet Under without Twin Peaks. There are so many programs that we take for granted today that most likely would never not, as I said before, not only not have been shown, but maybe never even been devised without the inspiration of David Lynch. And thankfully, as I said, he went on to make some more films that were visually exciting and confusing and strange and absurd, but they always had an optimistic sense flowing through them. Wild at heart, a very aggressive and loud but exciting film with Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, who became a very frequent actor in many David Lynch projects, as well as Kyle MacLachlan, who was first in Blue Velvet with Laura Dern. And then, of course, Kyle MacLachlan played Sergeant Dale Cooper in Twin Peaks and became a star, and he later went on to star in Sex and the City and things like that. But Wild at Heart, and then we just go on and on. Lost Highway, another very difficult film to understand, but one that you can't help but just stay riveted to, with Patricia Arquette and Bill Pullman, and a great cameo by Robert Blake, of all people. And some interesting music as well. Music always played a huge role. And then 2001, perhaps what people consider probably his best film, Mulholland Drive, filled with mixed identities, mixed realities, dreams, you name it. Once again, try to figure out Mulholland Drive. You really can't. David Lynch films were a feeling. They weren't so much of a story as they were a feeling. They were a collection of images and actions that were interconnected to a story, but sometimes were meant to distract. As I said before, the best way to look at a David Lynch film is to think of it as a dream, as an alternate reality. Because if you think about your dreams, there are recognizable people in your dreams. There are sometimes regular stories of your dreams. And then you go, and then this happened in my dream, and I don't know what the heck that meant. Well, David Lynch was brave enough to put that, and then there was this other part of my dream, which I don't know what the heck that was. Well, that's what David Lynch fed on. Not just telling the story of your dream, but telling all the convoluted, mysterious, unexplainable detours that your dream takes. His movies were dreamlike. The music accompanying them were dreamlike. The music encapsulated all types of emotions: hope, mystery, love, horror, destruction, and happiness. The theme to Twin Peaks at the very beginning of the show that was written by Angelo Badalamenti, who was a frequent contributor and collaborator with David Lynch, is one of the most beautiful pieces of music that I've ever heard. And I can just listen to the Twin Peaks theme soundtrack album on its own. The Twin Peaks was quirky cool. it didn't make sense all the time, but you didn't care, because the images and the scenes were so memorable within themselves. Even if they didn't make sense and push the story forward, it didn't matter. They were so visually shocking or visually arresting or visually compelling that you accepted them. The little dancing man with the red suit who spoke backward, right? What is that? We didn't know, but my gosh, we couldn't take our eyes off of him. And David Lynch went on to do other things within the pop culture and art world. He was a painter. He had exhibitions. As I said, he was a songwriter in his own right. He was a producer. He helped produce a greatest hits album that really helped, as I said before, rejuvenate Roy Orbison's career, right, until he died, sadly, in 1988. A singer named Julie Cruz, who had this angelic, fragile voice, became one of his frequent collaborators because her voice fit perfectly with the kind of music that he wrote for his films, which had a sense of hope and fragility as well as mystery. And sometimes danger. As I said, it's so hard to really encapsulate someone like David Lynch. Interesting enough, which I wanted to mention, when he was at Boston, when he was like 19, one of his roommates in art school in Boston was Peter Wolf of the Jay Giles Band, which I never knew until recently. So he had an interesting career. If you ever say, well, I don't really know if I've ever seen David Lynch. Well, he used to do the voice of a character a lot of times on Family Guy and then ultimately on The Cleveland Show, which was a spinoff. And did you just recently see the Steven Spielberg film from a couple of years ago called The Fablemans, kind of a autobiographical film about Steven Spielberg's life and sort of making films at a young age? Well, if you see the scene where the young character, the young filmmaker character, goes to meet the legendary director, John Ford, you'll know that it was David Lynch who played John Ford in a great little cameo. Pure Lynch, no doubt about it. A couple of years ago during COVID, on Netflix, there was a 15-minute film written, directed, and starring David Lynch. Once again, that's the guy never stopped with interesting ideas. It's a short film. It's on Netflix. It's called What Did Jack Do? I'd love for you to see that as just a little precursor to David Lynch. It's 15 minutes. It won't take up much of your time, but I guarantee you, you will be transfixed in this black and white 15-minute film about a police interrogation of a murder. Now you say, Jim, now what's so unique about that, right? We see that every time on TV. What's so big about a black and white interrogation scene of a murder? That's on every episode of Law and Order. I mean, give me a break. Well, you've never seen an interrogation scene like this, where David Lynch plays the police detective who is interrogating a talking monkey for the murder of his girlfriend, a chicken's lover named Max. Yeah, that's right. A talking monkey named Max who was going out with a chicken and who killed the chicken's lover. What did Jack do? Jack is the monkey. I guarantee you, you will not be able to take your eyes off of this. I guarantee you. As I said at the beginning, David Lynch was not a simple artist. He really embodied what the art life was all about. He embraced it, he lived it, and he shared it. And his ideas were unique. They were his own. He was a true original. And through that original artistic vision that he had, he not only created a body of work that will stand the test of time, it already has, and it will continue for decades, if not centuries. But as I said before, it also inspired so many people and will continue to inspire people because of his bravery and his individuality and his originality, and most of all, his honesty and his truth. These stories that he tells, and the way he tells them, yes, they are often crazy, confused, strange, but what keeps me coming back to them, that they are told from a perspective of honesty for that story. He's telling it the way he wants to tell it, not the way that you want to see it. And that's what true art is, by a true artist who is sharing his creativity and forcing the listener or the looker or the audience or the film watcher to share in his vision. He didn't make films to please your vision. He made films to please his vision, and he urged you to come into his world. He didn't go into yours. And that's what a true artist does. He shares his vision or her vision and invites you in to share with it. Many creative people try to give the audience what they want, and they have huge careers and they make a lot of money and they're very popular and very successful. But a lot of times their art doesn't last and doesn't stand the test of time, because if it was made for a moment or a specific period in time, and those kind of eras and perspectives go by the wayside, the future people to come can't understand the context, and as popular as those things were at the time, they don't resonate with future generations. But the true artists from any age, whether it's Da Vinci or Michelangelo, they created their art and invited, or it's sometimes challenged or forced us, the audience, into their art, into their world. They didn't compromise their artistic vision. They shared it with us and offered us a chance to share it with them. So it's very sad to see that someone with such a unique vision and a unique artist is gone. But at the same time, he leaves a compelling artistic life and compelling artistic work of art for us to enjoy, for us to be confounded by, for us to be compelled by, for us to be entertained by, for us to laugh at and laugh with, for us to try to figure out, and for us to realize that we can't figure it out and we shouldn't figure it out. We should just enjoy the experience of it. I hope I've given you enough of a tantalizing tease on the career and life of David Lynch that you'll take a chance on him. If you're like me, who's a David Lynch fan, you know what a great talent we have lost. But we also know what he has left behind and how we continue to be entertained and moved and touched and influenced by it. David Lynch passed away at age 78. The owls are not what they seem. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you've enjoyed episode number 453. I'm Jim Tirano, and here on business, I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears. It's a damn fine cup of coffee, Coop.